And this morning, yeah, I'll be telling you about the Event Horizon Telescope, what it is, how it works, how it's already getting information on sub-horizon scales for a handful of nearby supermassive black holes, and how we're using that information to address some fundamental questions in black hole science. Now, a project like this has many contributors, and here's what is surely now an out-of-date and incomplete list. The people in green are people who I've collaborated directly with on some of the results that I'll be showing you today. And in particular, I want to single out Jonathan Bittner and Tim Johansson, who are graduate students in this collaboration. All right, so starting at the beginning, what is a black hole? And I'm sure most people in this room have a pretty clear idea, but nevertheless, just so we're clear on the terminology, what is a black hole? And the answer is, of course, it depends on who you ask. You ask people at Hollywood, you get good things to fly ships into. And it turns out that's not such a bad definition, the idea that a black hole is defined by its horizon. It's an object whose interior is causally disconnected from the external universe, or from which the external universe is causally disconnected. And that's a good empirical definition, and I'm going to return to that a little bit later, because we can start to test whether or not objects like that exist. If we talk to a general relativist or a physicist, we might hear about Einstein equations, vacuum solutions, and the no-hair theorems. And the nice thing about that is that these things are actually quite simple, characterized in principle by three numbers and in practice by two, if we're interested in the astrophysical variety, the kind that we think are really present out in the universe. Okay, so this gives us some hope that there's some generality, they're relatively simple objects, and the reason why we talk about them is because they're simple to understand. But, of course, if we talk to an astronomer, we get a very different picture because they're interacting strongly with all the luminous stuff around them. That is to say, we have a whole lot of astrophysical hair. We might not have gravitational hair, but we have astrophysical hair. As a consequence of the brightest objects in the universe, they somehow accelerate ultra-relativistic jets, et cetera. And they tend to come in two flavors, the stellar mass variety, it's 10 solar masses associated with the endpoints of mass of star evolution, and the supermassive variety that inhabit the centers of galaxies with masses of millions to billions of solar masses. And I'm going to be talking today about using imaging of these supermassive black holes to test general relativity by observing this astrophysical hair. Now, surely general relativity has been tested before, and it's passed with flying colors. Here's some plots from the Living Review articles by Clifford Will, and there are a number of tests in addition to just a few that I've listed here. But most of these, in fact, all of these, have been in the weak field regime. And so when we want to talk about what gravity is doing near black holes or on cosmological scales and universal scales, we have to extrapolate. And that's a four-letter word, so regardless of what the grammarians say. So we want to have some way of testing strong field gravity directly. And people have been working on this, looking at compact object mergers, trying to detect gravitational waves from them and predicting the gravitational wave signals from them. Of course, they should detect them in the next decade or so, but have not done so yet. Alternatively, there are a number of electromagnetic signals that people have tried to pin their hat on, things like the quasi-periodic oscillations of X-ray binary spectra, the iron fluorescence lines in some AGN spectra, and even fitting out the continuum spectrum of X-ray binaries, all in an effort to probe the physics and the dynamics of material close to horizons. However, in all of these cases, there's a fundamental degeneracy between the location and dynamics of the emitting region and the structure of the space-time. So in all of these cases, you're using these to measure something about the black hole, assuming general relativity is right. And as a consequence, we can't even answer simple questions like, do black holes exist? Usually, you hear people try to answer these questions with things like, what else could it be? Okay, if you believe GR and you believe we understand nuclear physics, then I guess they have to exist, but that kind of begs the question. And so today I want to tell you how we're going to start getting some answers to these kinds of questions using imaging. I'm going to begin with what we need to do to image black holes on horizon scales and how we are doing it, how we're generating images theoretically and using them to help interpret these results, and will in the near future use them to constrain things like the quadrupole moment of Kerr black holes. I'll give you the most strongest argument that I know how to make for the existence of horizons, that Hollywood version of a black hole, this thing that you fall into and you don't get back out, does exist almost certainly in at least one case. And I'll show you how we can do geodesy with hot spots, not just stellar mass black holes. And finally, if I have some time, I'll tell you a little bit how we're going to use imaging not only to study the central black hole itself, but also study the retinue of stellar mass objects in its vicinity. All right, so if we want to image a black hole, what do we need to do? Imagine for a moment imaging a black hole against a bright, uniformly bright external universe. So you can imagine imaging against the CMB or imaging against Olber's universe. In any case, some place where photons that go off come from infinity, so if we time reverse, they go off to infinity, come to us, are bright, and photons that originate somewhere on the paths that connect the horizon to the observer are dark. We end up with a picture that looks like this. It's an uninteresting circular silhouette, characteristic scale of about 10 gravitational radii. If it's rapidly spinning, it shifts over a little bit, it's a little bit smaller, but it's really 10% effects. So the kind of scales we need to resolve are about 10 gravitational radii. Of course, we're not talking about imaging it against the CMB. We're talking about imaging the luminous emitting plasma in the vicinity of the horizon. And so we're talking about making pictures like this. And I'll describe how we do that and the morphology of this image in a little bit. But suffice to say that you can see that silhouette against the nearby luminous matter, and that's really the scale we need to resolve. Okay, and now numerically, in angular diameter order, the targets for this kind of experiment are listed here. Topping the list is Sagittarius A star. That's the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. It's about 4 million solar masses, about 8 kiloparsecs away, and comes in at about 55 microarc seconds across. For reference, a microarc second is about 5 picoradians, so this really is a very tiny angular scale. Next on the list is M87. 1,500 times more massive, 2,000 times further away, gives us a similar angular scale, 40 microarc seconds. There's a slew of other objects between 20 and 10 microarc seconds across, but many of these are probably too dim for the first incarnations of the telescope I'll describe to image, although maybe in 5 years or so we'll be able to do them as well. For reference, here's a stellar mass black hole. That's nano arc seconds in scale. It's femtoradians. I think that's a project for graduate students. All right, so what limits modern telescopes is diffraction. So if I take my telescope out back and I image a star, I don't see a point source, I see an airy pattern. And the size of that airy pattern is proportional to the ratio of the wavelength to the aperture diameter. So that means, and just to prove that point, here are some images from 8-meter and 10-meter class telescopes in the infrared, and you see wonderful airy patterns around the individual stars. So this really is true. We are diffraction limited now. So if I take my backyard telescope out, I get down to resolutions of 600,000 microarc seconds. So I won't be doing this from my backyard. If we use Hubble, it's 100,000 microarc seconds. Those 8-meter and 10-meter class telescopes, 20,000 microarc seconds. Next generation telescopes, the superlative telescopes, of which my favorite is the overwhelmingly large telescope, 100-meter diameter, 2,000 microarc seconds, two orders of magnitude, too low resolution. It may seem hopeless to go to longer wavelengths. At 3 millimeters, I would need a telescope that's 6,000 kilometers across to get down to just 100 microarc seconds, but just such an instrument exists and has been operating for almost 2 decades. And the way that works is by using a technique called radio interferometry. And here's my one of two slides on how that works. So we imagine we have two telescopes separated by some distance and a point source up here that emitted a radio plane wave, and that reaches one telescope a little bit before the other. That is to say, the electric field measured at the first telescope and the second telescope are identical up to a fixed phase shift that depends just upon the geometry, the angle, the separation, and the wavelength. So if I cross-correlate the signals of the two telescopes, I get a cross-correlation peak with a height that's given by intensity, modulus of the electric field, times a geometric factor. All right, and this is really a complex quantity. So that's not very interesting. But if I have an extended source, I have to add these contributions up across the source. And I end up with something called what we call a visibility, and that's just the Fourier transform. It's the integral of this across the source, just the Fourier transform of the intensity distribution on the source. So that means that this visibility is the component of the Fourier transform at an angular scale of lambda over the separation now, not the aperture size. Okay, so if I want to make very high resolution images, the story goes, I get a lot of radio telescopes, I put them around various places, and I measure the electric field at each telescope, do my cross correlations, get those visibilities, sample the Fourier plane, or I'll call the UV plane, and when I have it sampled well enough, I invert that, and I get an image, and this is how all those wonderful radio images that you see are produced. And an instrument that does this on Earth-size baseline exists. That's the Very Long Baseline Array. and they just spread the telescopes across the Earth. Okay, and it's been doing this at wavelengths of 3 millimeters and longer for almost 2 decades. Unfortunately, that gets you down to 100 microarcseconds, and we want to resolve 50. Okay, so making the Earth bigger is hard and expensive, but making the wavelength shorter is doable, and that's what the Event Horizon Telescope is. It's an analog of the Very Long Baseline Array that operates at millimeter and submillimeter wavelengths, and that allows us to reach angular scales of 30 and 20 microarcseconds. And fortunately, to do this, we don't have to build a whole new slew of radio telescopes. We can already use a number that are operating presently. There are sites in Hawaii, California, Arizona, and Chile, as well as a pair in Europe that can be used. In the near future, the LMT will come online in Mexico. ALMA comes online in Chile, increasing sensitivity tremendously, meaning we can see dimmer features. And the South Pole Telescope can even be used if somebody builds a receiver for it, and I'm told by my observing colleagues that that's actually relatively straightforward. Now, like everybody else, we've put our markers down on the ALMA prototype dishes. So these are 3 dishes that were created to test for design for ALMA, and they're sitting around, and everybody and their brother has a plan for what to do with them, and so we thought we might as well. And so we thought, where would we put them? Ideally, you'd want to put them in the middle of the Pacific, but there aren't any high mountains there. So it looks like New Zealand and 2 places in Africa provide the best additional baseline coverage. If you'd like to read about the costs, the strategies, and the plans of the Event Horizon Telescope, we have an Astro 2010 science paper. It's extremely well received by the Decadal Review, and in fact, this project was listed as one of the examples of why you need to have small project funding. I'll put this address up at the end as well. All right, so I don't want to give you the impression that this is easy. There are a lot of complications at moving to shorter wavelengths, but I don't need to read this slide because it works. These have all been solved, all the problems and the difficulties. And in 2007, they were able to measure those visibilities on the Hawaii-Arizona baseline. And this picture up here gives you an estimate or an idea of where in that UV plane they measured them. So they only measured them at a handful of points. Everywhere you see a green point, we know what the Fourier transform of the image of Sagittarius Star looks like. All right. And here are the amplitudes. You notice this is more or less in one line, so they plotted them along that line. And here are the amplitudes of those visibilities, and they fit a Gaussian to it because the zeroth order, everything's a Gaussian. And they got a typical size of 37 microarcseconds, plus or minus 14 microarcseconds, and those are the 3 sigma error bars. So you'll note that this is actually sub-horizon. This is smaller than the 55 microarcseconds that I advertised for Sagittarius Star. So already in 2007, they had information on smaller than horizon scales. They went back and did this again in 2009, got visibilities at a number of different points. If we add them all up, it looks like this. Okay, so a bit better than 2007, but not a whole lot. I want to emphasize that this is the beginning. Okay, if we include the possible baselines that you expect from all the other telescopes that I showed there, minus the ALMA test dishes, okay, I haven't included those, you get tracks in the UV plane that look like these. Okay, and we've only looked at these green points here. So there's a great deal of information yet to get. Nevertheless, all of the results I'm going to talk about are from these green points. Now, because there are so few green points, you can't invert the Fourier transform and produce an image right away. And so we have to leverage what we know about what the source should look like, leverage something about accretion theory to try to say something intelligent about what it should look like. And that means we have to be able to theoretically compute images of stuff around black holes. And so that comes in a few steps. The first is you have to be able to trace photons around space-times. That's actually straightforward. Next is you have to be able to perform radiative transfer along those photons. We do the fully polarized radiative transfer, and we worry most about self-absorbed synchrotron emission. This is computationally the most difficult part. It takes all of the time. But conceptually most difficult is figuring out what the plasma that's emitting is doing, where it's located, how it's moving, how it's magnetized. And we have some idea of what that ought to be from previous studies of Sagittarius Star. And we think that radiatively inefficient accretion flow models are a good bet, so those are the ones we employ. These are very thick disks characterized by the weak coupling between the ions, who get all the energy as they fall towards the black hole, and the electrons, which emit all the radiation. Okay, so that results in hot, thick disks. And we use a semi-analytical model, so we have a self-similar disk. We set it moving on Keplerian orbits beyond the innermost stable circular orbit, and we let it fall in ballistically inside of that. We endow it with a magnetic field that's toroidal. And we have 2 flavors of electrons. We have a thermal flavor, and a power law high energy tail. I say thermal in quotes because remember, they're weakly coupled to the ions, so they're not in thermal equilibrium with the ions. We could use simulations, and that's one of the things that we'll do in the future. But they're, for many reasons, it's not clear simulations are any better than this, and this is certainly easier to compute. Yeah, it looks very much like simulations. It's like a smoothed out version of simulations. Right, so these electrons are have a lower temperature than the ions, and not thermal equilibrium. So they're Maxwellian, but not really thermal. And in the end, our model is defined by six numbers. Okay, normalizations for the thermal electron density, non-thermal electron density, and thermal electron temperature. And the structure is fixed, but we can move them up and down. Say there's more electrons or fewer electrons. And then by the three components of the black hole spin, so six numbers. Now, any model that we have for Sagittar has to be consistent with a whole bunch of existing data. And in particular, we better be able to fit the spectrum and polarization properties. And so we set those normalizations, electron density and temperature normalizations, by fitting the millimeter radio spectrum of Sagittar. And so that means that we have a library of models that are cataloged by spin vector, and that's it. So you give me a spin vector, I can give you a model which fits all of the current data for Sagittar, and with that I can go and compute images. And this is for different spins. They all have this typical crescent morphology, and that arises first from the orbital motion of the plasma around the black hole. The side coming towards us is bright, the side going away from us is dim, and because of lensing about the black hole. And that's different for different spins. Okay, so you can go and try to tell these apart. And this is what we're going to compare to those millimeter VLVI visibilities. There's also some intervening propagation effects we have to worry about, but they're subdominant.
Stationary?
Yes, for now we're going to assume, but we'll get to non-stationary things in a moment.
And you're also assuming GR, right?
And we're assuming GR when we make these images, but we're going to talk about departures in that moment, too.
So those images, are they from Sagittarius A data itself, or are they just...
These are theoretically produced images that we're going to compare Sagittarius A star data.
So no Sag A in that so far?
Not so far. Right. It's consistent with everything we know about it. Okay, but those don't come directly from images. All right, so I want to compare a bunch of models, not just a couple that I made. And to do that, we need some sort of statistical scheme for discussing significance. And for that, I'm going to use these information criteria, and in particular, the Bayesian and the Kaki information criteria. Okay, these are really just a way to get a handle on how significantly better a given model is than another, and they're related to the chi-squared statistic. So this L is the log likelihood. You can just stick chi-squared in there. But they're penalized by an amount that depends upon the number of parameters in the theory, K, and the number of data points. So if you add a parameter to your theory, you expect it to do better, but how much better does it have to do? And these information criteria give you a handle on that. Did it do better enough to have justified adding that parameter? And you can calculate a relative significance, or you can compare them on the Jeffrey scale. I love this category. It's my favorite statistics category of all time. Not worth more than a bare mention. Okay. But before people start maligning statistics, I want to point out that in all cases, the difference is obvious. And we're going to be focused only on the very strong and conclusive categories between the different models. Okay, so this just gives us a way of telling us how significant the obvious improvement is. So the first model I want to show you is a phenomenological model. This is this Gaussian. It's the zeroth order model for Sagittar. So there's the intrinsic image, scatterbonded image, visibilities compared to the observed points at which the visibilities were observed. And you can go and, so this actually has five parameters. It has one structural parameter, and it has four flux normalizations, a separate flux normalization for every epoch, the 2007 and the 3 days in 2009. So we let the flux go up and down, but we say the structure can't change. And you can look at each epoch separately, and what you find, and these are the chi-squared surfaces in each epoch separately, and you find that they're all consistent with a single structure. So that's justified. It doesn't look like there's any structural evolution. And in all of the models I'm going to show you, the structure is fixed. Okay, you don't necessarily expect that to be the case, but it appears to be so here. And we get some estimate for the size of that Gaussian. And if you multiply this by the appropriate factors to convert it to a full width half max, you get roughly the same number, certainly a number consistent with the one I showed you before. And we have a reduced chi-squared of about 1.2, and the information criteria shown here, although their absolute values aren't important, it's only the differences that matter. So this does passably well. The next order model you might consider, or phenomenological model you might consider, is an asymmetric Gaussian. So the next order, you let the thing move out in some direction, become asymmetric. So now you have two extra structural parameters. You have an asymmetry parameter, and you have a position angle on the sky, how it's oriented. Again, consistent with a single structure for every epoch. Find a reduced chi-squared, 0.2 smaller, so significant improvement there. And you can see that the asymmetry parameter is very clearly not zero, which would correspond to the symmetric case. And the information criteria are 7 lower than the symmetric case. This puts it in the very strongly preferred category. Okay, so we very strongly prefer asymmetric configurations for Sag A star to symmetric configurations right off the bat. So we make a good case for that. And then we can go off and compare our accretion flow models. And this is the best fit model, again, scatter broadened version. Okay? And that does even better. That says information criteria that are 8 lower than the asymmetric Gaussian, 15 lower than the symmetric Gaussian. So conclusively preferred over the symmetric Gaussian case. So we're absolutely sure Sag A star is not symmetric. And very strongly preferred over the asymmetric case. This does much, much better, 100 times better than the asymmetric Gaussian. And it's worthwhile asking why. What's different about this than the asymmetric Gaussian? And the answer is, if you look closely, there's a little bit of curvature. I mean, it does look like an extended Gaussian type thing. But there's a little bit of curvature in the shape. And that little bit of curvature spreads out the visibilities, and that's what makes it fit the visibilities better. Gives it a better chance of fitting them. And that curvature is drawn, governed directly by the lensing around the black hole. Okay, so my accretion model is almost certainly wrong. Okay, but you hope that the general relativity is more or less right if GR holds, and then that's what dictates this curvature, and that's what we're being sensitive to right now. So we've already seen some evidence for strong lensing. And so when people ask me, what does a Sag A star look like, and when will we see a nice pretty picture like this, I think in some critical aspects we can say we already have. So this is the intrinsic image, and this is after it propagates through the plane of the galaxy to us. There's a whole bunch of junk in the way that scatter broadens images.
So if we think we understand the junk right, it looks more like the same left.
Exactly. Exactly. And how the junk affects things has been empirically measured. You look at point sources and watch how it runs.
That, it looks like that brightness around the upper left there, but we see uniform spread.
It's not edge on, so it's at a significant inclination. You mean why is it brighter down here and a little bit dimmer up there?
Yeah, sort of loops in more.
Yeah. So that stuff that you're seeing there is actually emission from stuff in front of the black hole. And if the disk is tilted a little bit like this, right, you see more in the bottom than you see in the top, because we're looking down the funnel of the donut. So 71 minus 7. It turns out this has the same number of parameters as the asymmetric Gaussian. So we have 3 spin parameters. Yeah, it's probably low because the observers estimate their uncertainties, and they tend to make conservative estimates. That's a good question. That's what they tell me. I mean, the people who write the observation papers are on this paper as well, and so we talked about this extensively. Yeah, but it requires a 15% correction in your error bars, and the error bars on the error bars are much bigger than 15%. But it suggests that they're better than they think they are. Yeah.
So what about the spin now? What is your best fit spin estimate?
Glad you asked, Brian. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about getting out. So I didn't tell you what the structure parameters were for that image because we can do a more sophisticated analysis in this case since we have an idea of what the priors on the spin ought to be. In particular, before this, we assume we know nothing about the direction of the spin. And so here's the posterior probability shown by spin magnitude on the horizontal axis, inclination relative to the line of sight on the vertical axis, and each panel shows you a different position angle on the sky. Okay, different orientation and spin on the sky. And I'm showing this for the 2000 data alone. So these are, remember, where we had visibilities measured. And the maximum probability in this picture is about 15 times the average probability if you said everything was completely unknown. Okay, so, you know, it's narrowly distributed into a two-dimensional surface, but 15 times. This is what it looks like now. With a little bit more data, we're very clearly constrained to a pencil, and in fact, very heavily weighted towards zero magnitude and an inclination of about 66 degrees. Okay, so we have a pretty good idea what the inclination is and the magnitude of the spin is. And the maximum probability is now 350 times the average. And I don't know if you focus over here on this plot over here, if you can see, no, it got a little bit better, but it didn't get a whole hell of a lot better. Okay, so small improvements in the data produce large improvements in our predictive ability, our diagnostic ability.
I'm having trouble seeing the scale, so that little diagram, you know, that's where it's got 300 times the max.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
The
maximum value is zero.
Oh, so
yeah. We don't fit counter-rotating disks because we don't quite know what to do with those. But we're going to get into simulating these things, and we can do it in that case, so we can start addressing that question. Yeah. But that's good for us. We get to live here because of that. If it were a quasar, it would be uncomfortable. Canadian winters would be the least of our problems. All right, so far I've been telling you only half the story. We've been fitting millimeter visibility amplitudes. And the reason why we've been fitting the amplitudes of those visibilities, the amplitudes of the Fourier transform, is because those are easier to measure. The phases get mucked up by atmospheric propagation effects. But you really would like to know something about those because first, you'd be able to solve a 180-degree degeneracy. If I take an image and I rotate it 180 degrees, I get exactly the same visibility amplitudes. So that picture I showed you was the best fit picture, but I could have rotated 180 degrees, and that would fit too just as well. So we'd like to be able to eliminate that. But secondly, because that phase information tells you a lot about the relative structure and especially asymmetric structures within the source. And that's illustrated here. We look at a sine distribution for intensity, same visibility amplitudes, but different visibility phases. And, you know, we've reflected the sign. So big difference produces big changes in the phase, but nothing in the amplitudes. So how do we go about getting phase information if it's always mucked up by the atmosphere? And the answer is by using these things called closure phases. So imagine we have three telescopes, okay, and at each telescope we have some phase fluctuation the atmosphere causing, and these are all independent. And we can go and compute what the visibilities are on a given baseline, and that's given by the expected value, the true value, plus some error terms that completely swamp this from the phase fluctuations at the individual telescopes. But if we add them along the triangle, you can convince yourself rather easily that these phase fluctuations cancel out exactly, and you end up with the true value. This is called the closure phase, and it's really just the argument of the bispectrum, if you're familiar with that. And this is what you can measure accurately. Unfortunately, there's never enough of these to reproduce all of the phase information, but it does give you some. And they measured this on that Arizona-California-Hawaii triangle that they'd been doing the millimeter VLBI experiments with, and they got 0 plus or minus 40 degrees. So they constrained that to within a quadrant of the circle. And that sounds maybe not terribly constraining, but you can go and ask, well, given the models that we have, you know, if we just put that isotropics prior on, how constraining is it? What's the probability of measuring a given closure phase? And already you can exclude more than half the models just from that single closure phase measurement alone. So it is relatively diagnostic. But we do know something about these models. They're not all equally weighted because we did fit those millimeter VLBI visibility amplitudes. We did constrain the probability distribution to a very narrow region in the parameter space. So we can ask, well, how well does that do? And in that case, 97%. Of the time you expect to find a closure phase that's within the observed limits. Okay? And I should emphasize this is not expected. This is not a priori expected because the closure phase measurements represent a completely independent check on the structure of the source. Okay, so it's interesting that our models seem to fit this extraordinarily well. And the reason is simple. The high probability regions are shown by these white contours, and they just kind of sit in these valleys of low closure phase, which are shown by the green color in the closure phase plots. Okay, so red and blue are bad, green is good, And we sit right in the green sections. So we kind of sit in this preferential valley. This is all going to get very much better in the near future as more telescopes are added to the array and as sensitivity improves a bit. And in the next few years, if it reaches the expected design sensitivities for a couple years out, we will be measuring closure phases with about degree precisions. Okay, so they'll provide a competitive constraint on the structure of the source. And so given that we have such discriminating power already, it behooves us to start talking about how can we go beyond that very simplistic model for the accretion flow. And you can do this in a couple ways. You can make more complicated accretion flows, include more astrophysics. But another and important way to do it is to mess with the space-time itself. All right, so we can start perturbing the background space-time and asking how does that change the images. Now, in the weak field, we know how to do that. The parametrized post-Newtonian framework gives us a definition for what a reasonable variation of general relativity is. In the strong field, it's really complicated, and we don't quite know how to do this. That is, we can make perturbations, but we don't know how to check if they were reasonable, if they made sense. And so far, we've been following kind of a scheme that we add mass perturbations, singular mass perturbations, and then solve the Einstein equation. So it's certainly not generic, and there are perturbations, classes of perturbations we won't capture this way. Okay. But nevertheless, it gives us at least a way to start talking about this. And the first way we've done this is by using and abusing the Hartle-Thorne metric. So this is the metric for a slowly rotating neutron star. And neutron stars don't have to have the same quadrupole moment as a Kerr black hole. So the solution outside of a neutron star is not Kerr. And you can quantify, well, what's a big perturbation then? Because I know what kind of big quadrupole moments I can keep on a neutron star are. Okay, so that gives me some physical context. And then you shrink the size of that neutron star down to zero, for shrinking inside the horizon. No, Hare theorems tell you you're not really allowed to do that. At some point, you create singularities, and you have to wave your hands and come up with a way to deal with those. And how you do that tells you, in some sense, how you think the correct theory should correct those singularities. Nevertheless, you can come up with innocuous ways of doing it, and you can make oblate and prolate black holes. And even by eye, you can tell the difference between these guys and a Schwarzschild black hole. And the difference is much larger than the difference between images that fit with high degrees of significance and don't fit the existing millimeter VLBI data. So we're in the process of constructing libraries of these kinds of models and asking how well we can construct those quadrupole moments, so start to test the no-hair theorems. We can go beyond quadrupoles, and this is being done with Dimitrios Saltis, graduate student Tim Johansson, and Avi Loeb. We can go beyond this with the bumpy black hole formalism developed by Sarah Vigeland and Scott Hughes. And that gives us many multiples, not just a quadrupole, but we can mess around with the octupole and the sextupole. But in that case, I don't have a good feel for what a big deviation is. So one of the big unsolved questions here is how to define reasonable. Nevertheless, we can start putting limits on those kinds of deviations. Now, I wanted to show you the best argument we can make for a horizon, because we don't have to do this modeling of variations of GR to start saying important fundamental things about strong field gravity. So I want to show you how we can make an argument for the existence of horizon. And it's based on one of these where did it go arguments that's been used to justify the difference in luminosity, or explain the difference in the luminosity between black holes and neutron stars in similar systems. And to do that, we have to understand why accretion is a little bit different on these two objects. So accretion onto a black hole starts out with diffuse stuff far away. The stuff falls, it gets compressed, gains converts gravitational binding energy into kinetic energy. Some fraction of that radiates. Then it crosses the horizon, and the story's done. And so what you see is some fraction governed by the physics of the accretion flow times how much binding energy was liberated. And typical numbers for that fraction for Sag A star, we think, are about 0.1%, and that's measured empirically by comparing the luminosity to inferred accretion rates. And for a quasar, it's something like 10%. Okay. For a neutron star, the story starts the same. But once that stuff slams into the object, something different happens. It starts to heat up. Okay? And very quickly, it reaches steady state. And so that you get that accretion luminosity, but then you also get everything else that was liberated, all the rest of the liberated gravitational binding energy out in surface luminosity. Okay? And if you have 10% efficiencies, that can be 10 times as bright as the accretion luminosity, and that's why neutron stars are so bright. And you can make the same exact kind of argument for Sag A star, except we don't have to know exactly what Sag A star would be made out of. Neutron stars, we think we know what they're made out of, but that's not the case with Sag A star. And so let's talk about what emission from a very compact object that isn't a black hole would look like. If it's sufficiently compact, And by sufficiently compact, I mean that it's within its photon orbit, whatever the theory of gravity. Then most of the photons end up getting lensed back onto the object, and only a handful escape. And we have a name for that kind of thing. We tell all our freshman physics students about it. It's the black body cavity. So if it's sufficiently compact that only a pencil beam escape, these returning photons serve to thermally couple the object to itself, and you end up with a thermal spectrum coming out. Okay, compact surfaces are black bodies. And that means if you tell me how bright it is, how big it is, I can tell you what the temperature is, or equivalently what the spectrum is, and I can go look for that emission. So if you give me a few assumptions, the zeroth order assumption is gravity is sufficiently nice that I can calculate some things in it, and I have some notion of energy conservation for the test particles. And the first astrophysical assumption is that Sagittarius A star is accretion powered. That allows me to relate the observed luminosity to the accretion rate via that radiative efficiency, and we think that's almost certainly the case. That Sagittarius A star has reached steady state. The typical dynamical timescale for Sagittarius A star is very small. It's lived for a long time. You think it would, and redshifts only save you logarithmically. That would allow me to relate the luminosity of that surface emission to the accretion flow luminosity. And you let me assume that it's a compact surface for the purpose of computing its spectrum. And that's what's implied already by that millimeter VLDI stuff. So we know that it's already quite small. All right, then I know what its spectrum should be. And then I can go make plots like this one, which show the radio spectrum, the near-infrared detections, near-infrared spectrum, and this green bump would be that surface component. And you can tell right away it's much too bright. Okay, so this is what we think would be right for Sagittarius A star. This is what would be right if Sagittarius A star had quasar-like efficiencies. Okay, you can make it cold and big, but that's exactly what's eliminated by the millimeter VLDI observations. And we can make all of these restrictions very explicit by looking at a plot like this. We're on the vertical axis. We have the surface luminosity plotted against the apparent angular size, or equivalently, the radiative efficiency plotted against the apparent angular size. And everything above this black line would create a bump that was too bright. It would have been observed. And everything to the right of that red light is too big. It would be bigger than the millimeter VLDI constraints. And we have to live down here. And I want to emphasize that these are direct observables. Right, so I didn't have to input a whole lot about gravity to get them. This is a property of the accretion flow. We think we understand the physics that goes into modeling that accretion flow. Certainly, it's happening at laboratory accessible scales. And you find that you live in a situation where the radiative efficiency has to be greater than 99.6%, which is just so absurdly large in comparison to anything that we could physically conceive of, given at lab densities, temperatures, and magnetic field strengths, that when asked, does Sagittarius A star have a horizon, do we have to be able to lose that material? It has to stop and give up all of its binding energy somewhere where we can't see it anymore. And the answer is almost certainly yes. Yes?
Science. Say certain. It depends on what assumptions go into that.
Yes.
So what if you give up some of these assumptions? You have like black holes, black body, steady state, thermal equilibrium. You have a metric theory of gravity. And you start giving up some of these assumptions, what happens?
Well, if you don't know if it's a black body, if you don't have a way to constrain the emission from the surface, you don't know whether or not you've been able to look for it yet. So then you start to relax whether or not it has a horizon. But then, you know, you do have to start talking about very different kinds of things. It can't be a high redshift surface. It can't be an extreme surface. So you have throwaway gravistars and boson stars and collections of objects and whatnot. One way to get around all this is maybe Sagittarius A star is a big wormhole that evacuates to an empty region of space. But if you want to entertain those ideas, okay, then you're right. You can get around these kinds of astrophysical limits.
Modify gravity theories today, not metric theories.
Right.
Well, we don't satisfy the Hermit's principle. We don't know that's true. It's such a complicated, strong gravity object. I'm not saying I don't believe what you're saying. It's just that there has to be some measure of.
I agree.
Measure of caution.
Wherein, absolutely. Wherein we've been able to calculate things in alternative object theories, we've found very similar limits apply. Okay, so we took the best model for a gravistar and looked at what it said, and you get the same answers. Okay, but you know, you're absolutely right. And at some point, you know, we're very creative people. Theorists are definitely creative people, and there's potentially ways to get around these kinds of things.
Well, since you raised the issue, how feasible is it to constrain whether it is or is not a wormhole?
Well,
you'd have to go back and do the analysis, but is something...
If it's a wormhole that connects to a deep void in space, how would you ever tell the difference, right?
Well, that's my question, yes.
Yes,
some...
Other than the fact that it ought not be stable, I don't know. So you're right. But wormholes have horizons, too.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So at this point, if you're willing to entertain that more unusual idea, at this point, you can't.
But that's the kind. So, you know, we can't ever, I don't think we'll ever be able to make the conclusive statement. So we always have to say almost certain, almost likely, whichever qualifier you want. But we can put those alternatives in a smaller and more extreme box. And this is the strongest constraint I know. So this puts it in the smallest, most extreme box that we have.
Okay. Okay, another question. This is the usual simple-minded question. You can never actually see horizon fall because we're sitting on Earth in coordinate time. So how close can we get to ever being sure that you have a horizon?
You'd have to wait an infinite amount of time to be absolutely sure. Yeah, sure.
I don't have an infinite amount of time.
Right, right.
How can I get next to the horizon of the black hole?
Right, right.
At least not in my lifetime.
Well, so I think then we can say, are there fundamental physics horizons? And how likely it is that you build a theory where you, well, you know, Hawking radiation, you wait an infinite amount of time and the black hole goes away, right? How long do we want to wait to define it to be for astrophysical purposes, at least a black hole? Well, that's a good question. And are there objects where things fall in and then we don't see them for nigh infinite amount of time versus forever? I guess that's a slightly different question. I agree.
Yeah. You try to read it with a telescope from here.
Okay. So Nyesh brought up a good point earlier on, and that is I'm assuming stationary models, and there are a lot of reasons to think that Sagittarius Star will not be stationary and smooth, but may perhaps show quite a bit of variability. You can make some timescale arguments. You expect to see features moving around on timescales of tens of minutes at least, and when you look in the radio, you'll have features in the accretion flow that will pop up and exist for hours, or at least many, many orbits if they're small. So you expect to see variations in the luminosity of Sagittarius Star and those kinds of timescales, and of course you do. And there are these flares that happen about once per day. You can see them in the infrared, you can see them in the X-ray, you can even see them in the millimeter, and for some subset of them, you might even see some periodicity if you have a little faith. And this might give you a motivation to think about orbital models for this, and that's exactly what we've done. And in our picture, these flares are created in a similar way to solar activity. Okay, you have magnetic fields that are being dragged around by the plasma, reconnects, converts magnetic energy into non-thermal electron energy. Those non-thermal electrons stream along magnetic filaments and radiate like the Dickens. All right, and you can see that here in solar prominence. Okay, except in an accretion flow, it's a little bit different because these electrons are never dominant. For the kind of accretion flow we think is appropriate for Sagittarius Star, the magnetic fields are constantly being dragged around by the ions, driving the reconnection, but the electrons never have enough energy to push back. And so even if you drop large amounts of energy on those electrons, they remain localized to the magnetic turbulent scale. So you get a little spot in the accretion flow, and the size of that spot depends upon what the magnetic turbulence is doing. Nevertheless, these electrons radiate rapidly. They're the fool with their money. As soon as you give them some energy, they immediately send it away, radiate it away, and any extra energy goes straight into the luminosity, and you can increase the luminosity by an order of magnitude or more before they ever would have enough energy to push back. And because they cool on long timescales and they shear on many periods, they're expected to be long-lived, and even better, they're local. So all this business about trying to understand the radial structure, vertical structure of accretion flows doesn't really apply here. We just need to understand what's going on right at the location of the spot. So that makes them simple. All right. Now, you might say, well, wait a minute, you told us this story about the image of Sagittarius Star, and then you just tell us that it doesn't apply because there are spots about once per day. It turns out during the time that they made those millimeter VLBI observations, Edge A star did not have any flares and was anomalously dim both times. Okay, now here's the green bar here shows the flux relative to the black line, which is kind of the typical flux, and that's a log scale, so a factor of 50% or more dimmer. So treating it as a quiescent flow during that period is justified, but generically it's not. And you know, apart from saying, okay, this is dirt we have to address, maybe we can say, is it possible to use these to say something interesting? And the answer is yes. If we have this hotspot orbiting, it gives us information about what the space-time is doing. It kind of temporally disentangles the bundles of photons that are produced by the accretion flow. And we can start to relate things like the primary and secondary image. And you find that in that relationship, the spin is encoded. And the reason for this is that that primary image is created by photons that come by the most direct route. That secondary image comes by photons that take a more circuitous route, spend more time near the black hole, and are more affected by its properties, in particular its spin. And this is a great experiment for VLBI because you're comparing two spots. And VLBI is an interferometric experiment, and it loves to compare spots. Okay, so we can show you a movie. There we go. Okay, this shows a movie of an orbiting spot. Okay, there's a primary and secondary image. You can even see a little bit of the tertiary image. And here are the visibilities. And you see those visibilities develop interference fringes every time the primary and secondary are about equal luminosity. And you can measure the shape and locations of those very accurately, and from that measure the relationship between the primary and the secondary very accurately. Okay. Now, that's not the only piece of information you have. You also have a light curve, so you have independent verification of its period. If you have the spectral index of the flare, which they do in most cases, and a flux ratio, you can compute in physical units the orbital velocity, because you know how the Doppler beaming works. You can even use near-infrared interferometry to get things like the orbital size and inclination, or you can just use what we think we know about imaging. And you can use polarization to tell you something similar about the relationship between the primary and secondary image. And I don't want to say any one of these is the way to go. I'm really talking about concordance modeling. But we do have enough information to robustly define the orbit. So even if it's not Keplerian, we can define the orbit and back out what the spin ought to be. Okay. And so then you can imagine doing an experiment like this. You have your accretion flow. You wait a little while, and there goes a flare. And that flare orbits for a short while, a couple orbits, and then decays away. And there's some orbital path that it had taken. And from that flare, you generate some images. And you look at where those the primary and secondary are. And you compare those. You make a spin estimate. And remember, these images, that spin estimate is constructed from these images, which are constructed by photons that follow a bundle that relates this orbit to observers at infinity. So in some sense, it's a very local spin estimate. And it's measured by the space-time that's sampled by those photons. Sometime later, you do this again. You see another flare. The flare orbits and decays. And remember, there's a flare about once a day. And you do the exact same thing. But now you're looking at a different set of photons that traverse a different portion of the space-time, again, giving you another local spin estimate. And you repeat this over and over and over again. And at the end of the day, you end up with spin measurements as a function of hotspot orbit. So it's not spin as a function of radial distance from the black hole, but it's spin parametrized by different regions of the space-time. And Kerr makes a very clear prediction for that, and you can test this. And you can even go beyond that and try to map out the space-time in a way very reminiscent of the extreme mass ratio in spiral tests of GR. In this case, you're looking at the propagation of gravitational waves, and in this case, it's electromagnetic waves, but it's very, very similar conceptually. Okay. Now, of course, in the gravitational wave case, they have a detection problem, and in the electromagnetic case, we actually have a validation problem. We see flares.
So,
probably not. So that's why it's important to have all the other handles on what its orbit is doing. So, yeah, here you have extra unknown of what they're doing, but you can calibrate it out because you have so many more handles on what's going on. All right, so we want to validate that the flares we see have something to do with orbiting spots. There are a number of ways to do that. One way is to look at shifts in centroid motion. There have been sensitive astrometric experiments. Okay, they didn't see it, but they wouldn't have seen it, but they're still looking. More interesting would be looking for changes in that closure phase. Remember I said that was sensitive to the structure of the image. And so if the spot moves from one side to the other, that's a big structural change. And so you might expect to see variations, and indeed you do. Okay, so this red line shows what you expect to see in a closure phase as a function of time for a given hotspot orbit and black hole system and triangle. And these black dots show simulated data using just APEX down in Chile. But if you use ALMA, everything converges very rapidly to the line. And remember, ALMA already has the water 6 dishes down there, and it's growing by the day. And you can do that for any variety of hotspot orbits and black hole spins and possible triangles, and you can tell the difference between many of them. All right, so you can start not only checking to see if it's a hotspot, but even backing out some of the parameters of it just by looking at closure phases. You can also cross-correlate polarization. For reasons which I don't want to go into, the polarization signal can be brighter than the total intensity signal. And when you cross-correlate the polarization, you expect to see very similar variations. And this is what it looks like on a single baseline, Karma, one Karma dish in Hawaii. You add a new receiver, which is already in the works or being built. I can't remember if they've started yet. And then it looks something like this. And if we add a few Karma dishes together, which they're already working on, then it gets even better. So again, in the very near future, we'll be able to start looking for these cross correlations, looking for variations during flaring episodes. And you can do this on a bunch of different baselines, a bunch of different hotspots and spins, et cetera, and say something interesting about what's going on with the black hole. Well, we can do it. We have sufficient resolution. But if you didn't have sufficient resolution, if you were looking with the VLBA, the closure phase would not show significant variations. The reason why you see large variations in comparison to your signal to noise is because you have sufficient resolution to be sensitive to that. This really is an Event Horizon Telescope project. All right, so in the last few minutes, I wanted to tell you how we're going to use the Event Horizon Telescope, not just to study the properties of Sagittarius A star and potentially M87, which I didn't talk about, but also to study the properties of the stuff around Sagittarius A star. And the way we'll do that is with high accuracy astrometry. And people have been doing this at 7 millimeters for a long time. Here's a plot from Mark Reed and Andreas Brunthaler's paper in 2004 showing the position of Sag A star relative to a nearby quasar. Most of this is just solar motion, and it's an extraordinarily constraining limit, actually, on how fast it could be going. And the first thing you see from that is that absolute astrometry is not what we're talking about. In fact, it's not even possible at any significant accuracy. Instead, we're talking about differential astrometry. So you pick two objects that are pretty close together, and you try to carefully measure the angle between them, and if one of them is a distant quasar, you assume that that defines at rest. Okay? Now, there are a lot of reasons why doing this is hard, especially at a millimeter. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail about any one of them. Suffice to say that there are ways to get past all of them, and at the end of the day, you can get down to microarcsecond accuracies. That means I can compare over baselines of years microarcsecond deviations in the position of Sag A star. And I can do that because of the unique properties of the Event Horizon Telescope. But what could you do with that? Well, we know that there's a cusp of bright stars near Sag A star. This is the infrared stellar cusp. It doesn't follow Bacall-Wolf, so it's not what you'd naively expect, but there is a cusp. And people like Dave Merritt go and model this, and they come up with evolving pictures of what the cusp should be as it relaxes and as it interacts with other objects further out. And some fraction of these stars evolve, produce black holes, and they sink to the center. And so you also have a remnant cusp. Okay? And these things have consequences. If we imagine our black hole in the sea of stars, every now and then we'll have more stars on one side than the other. It creates a gravitational force in that direction. There, of course, is a drag force, dynamical friction, in the other direction. And then after one orbital time scale, everything re-randomizes and gets pulled in another way. So there's a stochastic variation causing a jitter in the motion. And if this cusp were relaxed and the system thermalized, that would just be the thermal motions of Sag A star. So we're all familiar with this. It's just a version of Brownian motion. But it's not relaxed. And that means that I can study the distribution and content of that cusp by looking at the power spectrum of that jitter. Okay. And you can predict what the typical deviations are. So this is in gravitational radii, and this is in microarc seconds, the typical deviations over a given period. So that goes out and comes back. I mean, it's hard to tell if it went out. The second it turns around, that's easy to see. Okay? It goes out and comes back on a given time scale, a given distance. And if the cusp looks like stars and black holes, given what we've seen already, what you'd guess, then on a couple year time scales, you expect to see large deviations, all the way down to making extraordinarily pessimistic assumptions. And then on 20 year time scales, you'll see deviations. And these things are important if you care about how cusps form in the evolution of galaxies and evolution of the supermassive black holes at the center. It controls how many things there are to accrete, and it controls what the shape of those cusps are and where they came from. But if you care anything about gravitational waves, they're also extremely important because these cusps are the single bars for black holes. It's where they go to meet and bump into and merge with other black holes. And so the LIGO black hole merger rates are extraordinarily sensitive to the shape of these cusps, the density of those cusps. Okay? So this would give us an independent way to estimate those merger rates for typical systems. And then, of course, the LISA extreme mass ratio inspiral rates depend upon how many stellar mass black holes you have sitting around these objects. And if looking for lots of black holes is good, looking for one is even better. And so we might try to find evidence for a single intermediate mass black hole. And there's good reason to think that one might be present in the galactic center system. We see these massive S stars. And these are the things they watch carefully over 10 years, make orbits of the galactic center, and from that infer what the mass and distance to the black hole center is, stuff that Andrea Ghez and her group does at UCLA, Reinhard Genzel and his group does at MPE. But these things are too massive and too young to have been born there. Sag A star's tidal forces would have torn apart the birthing region. And so you have to come up with some way to get them there. And the kind of typical story, or one of the typical stories, is that they were bussed in. There's a globular cluster from far out. It fell in and deposited the stars there. But if you take the kind of standard vanilla version of that, you find it doesn't work because the globular cluster itself becomes tidally disrupted long before they ever get down to where they have to be, where we see them. And because it's tidally disrupted and these guys aren't that massive, they don't then fall in themselves. You can fix this up if you said the cluster was very tightly bound. If it was that tightly bound, it would have undergone core collapse and produced an intermediate mass black hole. Or equivalently, you could say it's bound to an intermediate mass black hole that got there for whatever reason. And that works, because that shepherds it in, and then it drops them off. But that means you have an intermediate mass black hole sitting around there on the kinds of orbits of the S stars, and it would have gotten there in the past million years, because that's how old these things are. And then you can ask, well, what kind of reflex motion does that put on Sag A star? It's just like looking for evidence of planets by looking at the careful reflex motion of stars. We're looking for evidence of intermediate mass black holes by looking at the reflex motion of Sag A star itself. Now, we can make something of a complicated plot here. We can ask the complicated question, if I just plunk down random orbits, where would I have not seen it already, but would see it with a microarc second accurate astrometric program over the next 10 years? Up here, high mass, distant objects we would have seen already. Very low mass, very close objects you'd need sub-microarc second astrometry to see. There's a big swath in the middle, which isn't a sharp boundary because you can have different inclinations and different orientation. But a big swath in the middle where you could see it. And everything to the left of this line here, though, would have coalesced within a mega year just from gravitational radiation. Okay? But the S stars live out here, so this is kind of the sweet spot that we want to look for. This is the typical masses that people think would be for that central black hole, thousands, maybe 10,000 solar masses. And so this is where we want to look. Okay, and so we can start addressing that question. So let me just put up some conclusions. Okay, first, I hope I've convinced you that horizon-resolving imaging experiments are occurring now. Not, in fact, I've been doing it for the past 4 years. It's not a pie-in-the-sky, wait 10 years kind of thing. Okay, based upon these, we believe Sag A star is asymmetric, and we believe we started to see some of the signatures of general relativity in those images already. So in some sense, images like this have already been produced. We're getting phase information, which should provide an additional important constraint on the models, even though our models right now apparently fit them very well, and that will get better in the near future. And the marginal value of additional incremental improvements in the data is very large. We can discriminate much more strongly based on small improvements in UV coverage. Sag A star probably has a horizon, modulo any number of the physical caveats that we discussed during the talk. And we're ready to begin placing quantitative constraints upon the no-hair theorem in particular, things like the quadrupole moment with imaging. And hotspots will help us do this even better in the future. And finally, astrometry opens up a whole new range of targets. This isn't just a tale of two sources. It's a tale of two sources and their families. And so quite apart from exappropriating what we know about Sag A star and M87 to other objects, we can start to ask questions about stuff right around them, which has significance for a broader context. And finally, there's the web address for the white paper. You can go look at that at your leisure. Thank you very much for your attention.
Why didn't you say anything about spin in your conclusion, given what you said earlier? I mean, you mentioned testing curve, but you, are you for some reason more reticent about the spin of this thing?
I have a good estimate for spin. I don't have a good estimate for the systematic uncertainties on my estimate. And, you know, so I'll leave the quantitative conclusion out of the long list of qualitative conclusions that we can make. Yeah, the question is, how wrong is the accretion model we used? I think the image we're getting is more or less right. Okay, but how do you connect that up to the underlying properties of the accretion flow model? And if I change the disk height, for example, does that change what spin estimates I get?
Okay, but if I impose priors, like the accretion model is right and GR is right, and are you willing to say something then?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Then we have a measurement of the spin and its inclination. It's 66 degrees off the line of sight. It's located at 52 degrees from east of north, and it has a value of 0 plus or minus 0.4.
So with all those caveats, you do have definite.
Absolutely. And well, we have even better than a single estimate. We have the probability distribution. So, and in fact, it's even better than that sounds because it's strongly correlated between the inclination and the spin value.
I guess I thought you might have mentioned that in the conclusions, but.
Yeah, well, but it does depend upon the systematic uncertainty.
Sure, of course.
John?
Reading paper, recent papers, observational papers, it appears that from the infrared observations, the stars orbiting Sagittarius A star are very young, which is strange because the black hole's been around a long time. From what I gather, the explanations for this are not entirely satisfactory. Do you have any comment about this?
So this is the paradox of youth. And the fact that they're young is problematic for a number of reasons. It's because you can't form them in their orbits. The tidal forces would have prevented it. So how did they get there? And they can't fall in on the time scale that they live. It takes longer than we live. There are a couple possible ways out. One was this busing model. With the bus model, where it's a globular cluster that was accreted.
Globular cluster have young stars?
Well, it's a dense region where stuff can be formed, right? So it's a young globular cluster. We know that there are a lot of bright clusters right around Sag A star, like the arches and others. So it's certainly a very a vibrant star formation region. So a young globular cluster, okay, first generation. And then if it accretes, then you can deposit the stars, but the problem, there are issues with that as well. We can start testing that, as you'd expect to see intermediate mass black hole companion in that case. Okay, so in the next 20 years, you need that kind of baseline to see that orbit, but the next 20 years with very high precision astrometry will carefully map out the motions of Sag A star, and if you see it go back and forth, then you know that there's an intermediate mass black hole, and that's one possible solution.
What's the upper bound on that intermediate mass thing? Is that known empirically?
Well, it can't be a million solar masses.
Right.
Okay, so if this gives you an idea of what kind of upper bounds there can be. So given a mass and given a size, we can rule it out already if it sits up here. Okay, so a million solar masses, anything, you know, even smaller than the S star orbits would be ruled out. Okay. But up to 100,000, maybe a few times 10,000.
That's okay. Yeah. That fast for me.
And when they simulate that system, they get numbers like 6,000, 3,000. So it's perfectly reasonable within the various constraints.
But how do you follow this black hole?
So this happens. One of the intermediate mass black holes?
No. What do we know about how you form supermassive black holes?
The things that I'm talking about will only indirectly relate to that, in as much as understanding accretion theory will be important to constraining that. Understanding the cusp will help us understand episodic accretion, tidal disruption events. But beyond that, a lot isn't known. We know that you can't just accrete at the rate we see in quasars emitting and expect to get supermassive black holes. You have to jumpstart the process somehow. So I think that's the big question. So now you can merge or you can accrete. I think accreting is probably where most of the mass comes from. But you have to start with something relatively massive at the beginning. You can't start with a 10 solar mass black hole at the first generation of stars. You need to have something like 1,000.
It's a quasi-star, right?
Quasi-star, that's right. That's right. Well, that's one way to do it, right? Yes, you can also have super Eddington accretion. How you form mass, that's a good question. And exappropriating the results that we get from accretion studies and deformation studies, outflow studies, will help us answer some of that question. I don't know how to answer the rest.
Maybe you could just explain briefly this black body assumption. So like how much deviation do I expect from black body if there is?
So you want me to give you a spectrum as a function of redshift, or how much deviation I'm allowed? That depends a little bit on what you think the properties of the surface are. So the one deviation that people talk about most often is having a very, very high heat capacity. So it takes a long time to come into thermal equilibrium. But it also depends on what you think you're going to replace the black hole with. If you have complete freedom to replace it with anything, let's pretend we replace it with something that emits only TeV photons. So then how do I know how much it should deviate from black body? I have to scatter that down and try to figure out, if it's emitting TeV photons, what does the lepton bath around it look like, and how does it scatter in that, what time scales am I looking at? Or maybe it only emits horizon scale photons. That's even worse.
Basically, so you're saying you cannot answer that question until somebody tells you what that's.
That's right. So the better way to think of this is we're making a small box. And creative theorists have to live in that small box then if they want to get out of having black holes.
Your certainty of the horizon depends on the assumption how much of a black hole it is. Black body it is.
Yes, yeah. Because if it's not.
If you realize that, then.
You don't know where to look.
You don't know what to look.
Yeah.
Because we know about black body physics.
Yeah. It makes it nice and simple.
Once we go away from that, we don't know what to do.
Right.
So you're correlating signals from the telescopes that are really far apart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So how do you deal with the data? How do you correlate signals from the telescopes over here and the ones overseas?
So you have to be able to record it all to a hard drive or some such thing. So this is a question of how VLBI works in practice. So you record the data at every location. There is no network with high enough bandwidth to do it in real time. We use the highest bandwidth transfer possible. It's hard drives on a 747. So you've got to record it, and then you bring it back to a big computer, and then you cross-correlate it, and it's even worse than that. So recording it is a hard problem in and of itself. The dishes we're using already exist. We don't get to build them. And that means to increase sensitivity, you have to increase bandwidth, and if you increase bandwidth, you have to increase the rate at which you sample the signal, you have to increase the rate at which you want to record it. So now we're using 4 gigabits per second recorders. That's going to move up to 64 gigabits per second. These specially designed banks of the hard drives. But then you have to correlate all of this. You first correlate it, you see nothing. Because you have to adjust the time delays and the location delays to within sub-millimeter precision. And so for a couple years, they had experiments before 2007. They didn't see anything. They didn't know if it was because they resolved out all the structure, there was no structure on the relative scale, or if a wire wasn't plugged in somewhere at a telescope, or if they just didn't find the right solution to the locations of all the telescopes. And that actually took quite a bit of time, because it takes a lot of computing power to sit there and over and over and over and over again sample this parameter space until you see a fringe, and then you can optimize. Okay, so then it's worse. But to answer your question, we copy it to disk and bring it in. And incidentally, that's the thing that you can't do with infrared and optical interferometry. So in that case, you have to do the full quantum experiment. You have to interfere the photon with itself because you're in the low photon occupancy limit. In radio astronomy, we're in the high photon occupancy limit. So everything's a nice classical wave. And so I have a perfect amplifier. I type copy, and I make a copy of my hard drive, and now I have another thing to compare with another telescope.
So how much data would you be transferring one go? How much would you have to store?
So figure a 2-hour observing run. Right now it's already 4 gigabits per second. Okay, so that's 10,000 seconds. Okay, so that's 10 terabytes, 400 terabytes is what you're looking at per thing. And then you've got to cross-correlate that. And it's a sizable computing challenge. But it turns out it's not the biggest one. Places like Alma have by far more significant computing challenges. For Alma, you design a special computer just to do this, from the transistor up. This has sufficiently few baselines that you can do this kind of thing on a Beowulf or a cluster. And so now they're using these software correlators, which you can, of course, change easily. It doesn't cost nearly the money. But BLBI has some of the biggest computers outside of the Defense Department, U.S. Defense Department in the world. But they do one thing. They add integers over and over again. In fact, they add 2-bit integers.
Okay, well, Avery's going to be around today and tomorrow, so track him down if you have any other questions, and let's thank him again.